Admiral Balfour, Rewan. Could you tell me how the news of the Falklands broke to you, please?
Well, HMS Exeter was sent to the West Indies in late March 82 to be the West Indies guardship and at the same time to take part in an American naval exercise called Red X, which is a very large carrier battle group exercise to prove a data exchange system which was being introduced into the Royal Navy, and Exeter had the first. So we were sitting in Key West with the Flag Officer Second Flotilla, Admiral Bob Gherkin, who was an old friend, embarked to allow him to get round some of his parish, and he was to come with us to Belize, where we were to be the guardship, and then fly home. And we were entertaining the local American Admiral for dinner when the chief yeoman knocked on the door and said, "Please, sir." And I pushed him away and said, no, come on. And he said, "No, it's very important." So I got up and he said, "There's been a drama in the South Atlantic and it looks as if we're going to have a big problem." And that was our first intimation that there was a big problem going to brew. Now, Bob Gherkin was in fact the admiral responsible for that area of the world, and it would have been his task to command any forces that were to go to the South Atlantic. So the first thing we had to do was to ring up Northwood, the headquarters, and find out whether, in fact, he was to command any forces or not. And much to his disappointment, he was told to stay where he was, and Admiral Woodward was going to take command because he had been exercising with the force off Gibraltar, and it was considered it was better for him to continue to do so than to have a change of personalities.
Had anybody in the ship been in combat before?
No, I don't think anybody had. And of course, this was the first thing that occurred to us. What do we do? And unlike those who were going to the South Atlantic immediately, we remained in the West Indies to get on with what was primarily a peacetime task. Now, it's worth just pointing out that the weapon systems in HMS Exeter, who was a brand new ship, just completed her first class trials, were unoperational. In fact, we had a new computer software program for the control of our weapon systems, and this was unproven. And at the time that the Falklands crisis developed, we were not allowed to use any of our weapon systems because they were unreliable. So my first problem was, how do I get our systems operational? And this entertained our minds for the rest of the month of April. Now, after our time in Belize, which was a routine guardship duty, we went to San Juan and joined the American battle group for this big exercise. The exercise involved two carriers and about eight guided missile destroyers and Exeter. Initially, we were going to be a non-firing ship, just doing data exchange trials. But the Ministry of Defense and the United States Navy agreed that this was a marvelous opportunity for Exeter to prove whether her systems were operational or not. And so we became a firing ship and were given three missiles to fire. And I will always be very grateful to Admiral Lyons and the others for putting us in the firing line on each occasion. As you can imagine, in an exercise like this, the targets, which are real aircraft, fly in from about 200 miles against the sort of main body of the force. And it's only those missile-firing ships that are actually in the track of the target who get an ideal opportunity to fire. And we were placed right on the bearing of the threat on the three different occasions, much, I think, to the annoyance of one or two of the American missile ships who were looking forward to being in the pride of place. This proved to be invaluable. First of all, we were able to validate the Link 11, which was the data system, and we had very good warning of each raid. But more importantly, we were able to carry out three live firings, and we actually hit three target aircraft. And this caused an amusing incident where the Americans said, "Please, could you take Exeter away, or there'll be no targets for the next exercise." And although the United Kingdom paid heavily, like $1 million for each target, unfortunately the actual range officer said, that despite getting the money, that went into the American Treasury, and he was down three targets. So please, in future, would we miss them rather than hit them? But for us, as the Falklands crisis was now developing into something much more serious than we all initially thought, this was a marvellous opportunity to bowl out all the problems we might have in our new weapon system. And in summary, we found that our computer software was very unreliable, the computer crashed regularly, and we decided that we were really not sufficiently operational to go to war. And I had the unpleasant task of sending a private signal to Admiral David Halifax, who was the Chief of Staff at Northwood, who I knew personally, to say that although we were very willing to go to war, I considered that it was very high risk and that the ship was not operational. This was accepted by Northwood and the Ministry of Defence, and unbeknown to me at the time, all stops were pulled out in Ferranti, who had manufactured the software, and in the research establishments to completely rewrite the software package in the hope that, were we to be sent south, we would have a new and more reliable software. I think I have to stop.
Did that mean you having to go to the UK?
No. The new software was rewritten in the research establishment and at Ferranti. It was then taken to the simulators at HMS Dryad, where each class of ship has a completely real simulation facility for training. It was validated on the trainers, and then it was taken to HMS Southampton, the second ship in my squadron, who was working up, having just been completed, and was validated at sea off Portland. And to jump ahead a little, by the time that we were ordered to go south at the early in May, the whole program had been rewritten, validated. A copy was flown out to us in Antigua. We then proved it in Exeter on the way to Ascension. And by the time we actually sailed from Ascension to go south in mid-May, we were confident that our system was reliable and effective.
So it was for about a month before you actually went off to Ascension Island.
Yes, we had this extraordinary situation of being all ready for war, knowing we were first reserve, worried about our weapon system being operational, not knowing that so much work was going on behind the scenes, and being told by Northwood, don't bother us, work out your own program, remain in the West Indies, and be prepared to go south at short notice. Well, I'd been a staff officer operations in the West Indies in the 60s, so it was no difficulty for me to select a few choice spots to go and wait. So we went to San Juan, where we operated offshore with the Air Force National Guard. Now, they fly A-4 aircraft and other fixed-wing aircraft in their National Guard. They were all ex-Vietnam pilots whose normal jobs were flying 737s or 707s or whatever. And they laid on the most marvellous air defence exercises for us off San Juan. And we had 3 days doing this, Saturday, a Sunday, and a Monday. And the Monday they'd specially taken off so they could do the third one. So again, we had excellent practice against low-flying aircraft, just the sort of aircraft we were likely to meet in the Falklands. And this did wonders for our team in getting good practice. And I might say that the Americans thoroughly enjoyed the opportunity to fly what they call real flying, which was at 50 feet over the water and doing all the things that they're not normally allowed to do. I might add the only penalty was that we all had very sore heads for about 2 days after we sailed from San Juan and needed to go to one or two of the islands to recover from their hospitality.
So the American Navy in Puerto Rico were 100% behind Britain?
Absolutely. Everywhere we went at this stage, people were obviously hoping nothing was going to actually happen and that the diplomatic negotiations would be successful. But there was no question, as far as the Americans were concerned, that they were right behind us, and they gave us every cooperation possible. Anything we asked for was available, and we have nothing but praise for their enthusiasm and their help in getting us prepared for war.
Did you come across any support for the Argentinians in the West Indies?
No, not really. I think some people felt that it was a pity if there had to be a fight. I think we all felt that. We found ourselves in this very strange position of thoroughly enjoying ourselves in the sun in the West Indies in late spring, which is a very good time of year to be there, in entertaining people and being entertained, just as if we were on an old-fashioned cruise, while everybody else was going to war. The diplomatic exchange was at its height, and nobody really being able to pinch themselves and say, hey, this is likely to be for real. So we had this unreal situation of living a normal naval life, visiting places, enjoying ourselves, and at the same time saying, well, how can we prepare to go to war in this relaxed atmosphere? And this was a main problem for me, to decide how much preparation should I be doing and how much relaxation. And that was a difficult decision.
Did you get the impression that your officers and men wanted to be part of the action?
Yes, very much so. I think we all felt that we wanted to go. But at this stage, we were still very unhappy about the weapon system. We were very conscious that if we did go to war, at the crucial moment, the computer might crash and we'd all be in real trouble. And so we had this difficult feeling of knowing we were unoperational, really, but wanting to go and take part.
Can you describe the moment when it came that you knew definitely that you were going?
Well, we had a number of amusing incidents in this run-up period. We appeared in the press on three occasions in UK and in America, saying that we'd been sunk with heavy loss. This caused our families enormous difficulty. And it was the first occasion when my wife, who ran the sort of family's buzz net, came into her own. And I will always be most indebted to Sheila, as would all the wives of the ship's company, for making sure that they got something of the truth from me as to where we really were and what was really happening. But it was quite funny for sailors to be talking to their wives on a telephone box in some island in the West Indies, saying, now I'm fine, we're in the West Indies, and them crying down the telephone saying, but I'm terribly worried, I think, you know, and trying to explain that the Falklands was about 3,000 or 4,000 miles away, and actually we weren't going to be there for at least a fortnight, so to relax. And it just shows how people have become accustomed to believing what they read in the papers, when it can be totally inaccurate. But it was the beginning of this problem of keeping the families informed and knowing what was really going on, rather than what they thought might be happening. We even had a case after being in San Juan with the American Navy. We had a number of press interviews, all of which were very supporting and friendly. And we then went to Tortola, and I was rung up one evening by a reporter saying, is there any truth in the rumor that you've been sunk with the loss of all hands? And I said, well, if it's true, you're talking to God or somebody, and if it's not, you made a big fool of yourself. And he laughed, and he said, well, there you are. You see, even the reporters believe the press. And I said, well, you're more naive than we are, but we don't believe it. And during this period, we were starved of information. It was already becoming quite serious. We didn't know what was happening. We didn't know really how to prepare. I wrote a number of letters to Admiral Gherkin, who was, in fact, my boss in UK, and he was back in UK at this time, helping the first reserves to work up and prepare. And he was extremely helpful in dropping me the odd letter, occasional telephone call, to try and keep me in the picture. But even he didn't really know what was going on. As far as Northwood was concerned, and the Ministry of Defence, they were completely swamped with the problem of generating the Navy. And it is not in any way criticism to say that they should have kept us more informed, because they'd never done it before. The problem was enormous. They were extremely successful in getting the Navy generated in such a short time. But the price was not to tell other people what was going on. And in retrospect, I still feel that it would have been most helpful if somebody like Bob Gherkin could have been briefed, who could then have the time to brief others, we would have then asked fewer questions and being less irritating to Northwood, because we would have known what the form was and what was expected of us. And that is a recurring theme through the whole of the Falklands drama, this lack of information. However, we were well served by the World Service, which to a naval person has long been our final resource in terms of information, and we all listen to the World Service avidly and have great support for it. Without the World Service, we really would have been in some difficulty of knowing what was happening. So we were ended up in Nevis, an attractive little island that I'd known before, with very friendly people, and we were giving a lunch party when the chief yeoman again interrupted, and this time he had the expression on his face that it was time to talk, and this was to tell me that Sheffield had been sunk. Now I knew that the whole situation was changing, and we had lost the ship. She was a DDG like myself, and I was first reserve. And it wasn't long after that evening when we got our message to proceed to Antigua to embark stores, a new software program which was being flown out on the BA flight that afternoon, and as soon as we had everything on board, we were to proceed at best speed for Ascension. So now we were in a totally different mood. The air had cleared, as it were. We were no longer in this limbo of peacetime activity with war going on around us, and we could, as it were, take a deep breath and get on with proper preparations, and our mission was now not in any doubt.
What was the voyage to Ascension like?
Well, we went to Antigua. I sent two officers on ahead and the chief stores to try and get organized. We had an amusing visit to Antigua, and our departure was marked forever for me by slipping in full moon and stars from Antigua Jetty with all the local people cheering us, and a BA 747 waggling its wings over the top of us had just taken off, and that was quite a send-off. The other thing in Antigua which impressed me, being an old West Indies hand, was to be hugged by V.C. Bird, the Premier, never known for his pro-British attitudes, with tears in his eyes, saying, "We are all thinking of you, you're doing the right thing, and we hope that you'll have no problems yourself." This was an amazing day for me. The last time I'd seen him, he was very angry with my boss, and we had to leave the room in a hurry, but that was 20 years before. So it was interesting to be in the West Indies and to feel this enormous support from all the islands, and Antigua was a good temperature of the attitude of the West Indian premiers. They were all very much behind the British government for standing firm against this sort of intrusion by the Argentinians. It was a matter of principle, and that had risen above the petty differences of local politics and their disagreements with detailed policy with the UK. And it was very reassuring to feel we had their support as well as everybody else.
Did you think that you would run into the enemy in any way on the way to Ascension?
No, I think we understood where the enemy was, even if the media hadn't understood. So we knew we had time. We had a week's passage to Ascension. We kept radio silence so that we could conceal our move from the West Indies to Ascension. And we took this opportunity to get down to proper preparations. And this was another point where the commanding officer had to make a decision. How do you wind your ship's company up? We had another week's passage from Ascension to the Falklands, so we had a fortnight. And I decided that the passage to Ascension should be training. So we went back to basics. We started doing all the basic training again, procedures, making sure everybody knew what they had to do, had time to ask questions. And we put no pressure on the ship's company during that period. And I believe that paid off. And we kept the tension out. And we did everything we could to make sure that this software worked. And we had a small team of experts with us. And we were all delighted to find that it was reliable. And then we made our first serious error. The book says that if you join an operation, in accordance with NATO procedures, which was standard RN practice, we should send a status or readiness signal to the Commander in Chief. Well, my ship had sailed for the West Indies with a peacetime ammunition load, peacetime stores, and no cold weather clothing. And so we were pretty poorly placed for our preparations. And we'd no idea what stores and facilities were available in Ascension. We understood that it had become a forward operating base and therefore had assistance, stores, victuals, and so on. And this is again where no information can lead you into real trouble. So I sent a status report, which was 4 pages, in accordance with the book. The reply is unprintable from Admiral Halifax, but basically said, if we all had time to write signals that length, we wouldn't have a problem. Well, being a signal officer, this hurt, because all I was doing was what I was meant to do. But it then dawned on me that, of course, the last thing one should be doing in this sort of operation is what you'd been trained for, and all the procedures had clearly gone out the window. There was no operation order, no brief, nothing came to Antigua for us. We were in the dark, and so we decided that the only thing to do was to shut up and get on with it. And we never opened our mouths again for 6 weeks.
What did you find once you got to Ascension?
Ascension was amazing. The first thing we found in Ascension was the Russian intelligence trawler or ship. And so that amused us. And then we began to worry, really, how much the Argentinians were getting from the Russians. But I think in retrospect, probably very little. I think the Russians very sensibly wanted to know what we were doing for their own benefit as much as anything. And they sensibly sent this intelligence gatherer to patrol off the Ascension Islands. But it would have been nice to know that she was there. Anyway, we seemed to have surprised her because it was dawn and we found her first. So we hoped that our keeping silence on the route had actually worked and that the Russians hadn't found us on the way down. And she definitely appeared to be surprised. We then arrived at Ascension, which is a pretty horrible place, and anchored off. And the naval officer in charge was a very old friend of mine called Bob McQueen, who was a straight-speaking aviator, who I liked very much. And I quickly flew ashore to him and said, you know, what on earth's going on? And he then filled me in, and I got my first real brief as to what had been happening, what the mood was, how things were being handled. And he said, what can you take south? And I said, anything you want, just load me up. I wish I had qualified that statement. By the time I'd got back to the ship in my little helicopter, a Chinook was hovering over the back end, and my flight deck was already unusable. It was absolutely covered. We had 400 bags of mail to start with, and they're big bags. We had torpedoes for us, we had torpedoes for other people, we had ammunition, we had stores, we had clothing, everything under the sun. Some of it for us, but most of it just dumped. And the principle was, once it got to Ascension, Bob found a ship, stuffed it on board, and sent it further south. And so Ascension really was a pipeline. And they had done a marvellous job, aeroplanes flying in, helicopters taking it out to ships. And there were two Type 21s who were just half a day ahead of us, going south as well. And they were equally full of kit. But it just showed how different everything is for real. There isn't really time for order. And so this is how it was all being done. Off the back foot, take it, sort it out, get on with it. I've solved my problem. You now take it on and pass the problem on and solve it yourself. Very reasonable attitude, in my view. And very refreshing to find. But it means you have to have people like Bob McQueen who understand to cut out all the bullshit and get on with the job. He was not having an easy time with his Air Force colleagues who were still trying to run the whole thing by the book. And the book doesn't work when it comes to this sort of practice.
But did all this stuff make you less than operational?
No, it just meant we were very full. The passages were full of things. I think if we'd been damaged, we might have had an effect. But on the other hand, we were not in the war area. We hoped to pass it all on before we got into a fight. And this became quite a worry later on, how to get rid of all this stuff, not only because we wanted to get it to the right destination in case we got sunk, but also we didn't really want to be encumbered with it.
How long did you stay at Ascension?
We arrived in the morning and gone by supper. And we spent all day fueling from a tank at the anchored there, being briefed, as I said, and just being loaded. And when the last helicopter had left us, we sailed.
And was the journey then much different?
Well, your whole attitude changed. You had sent your last letter home, which was an interesting experience to write to your family. That could be the last time, but we thought it was the last opportunity. So you had to make up your mind what to say. That was quite difficult. And we all had good laugh about that. We had a competition of who'd said what to whom, and most of which was totally, I think, untrue, but it anyway made people laugh. And we had a lot of cartoons. I don't think any of the cartoons ever actually went home, but they certainly amused the ship's company. And throughout this sort of period, I was still trying to play it in a slightly light-hearted way and keep the serious bit for the following week. Always concerned that I was open to the criticism of not taking things seriously enough. But I think it paid off. We, most of us, I think, did what I did, which was to send a separate letter to a relation. I sent a letter to my brother-in-law, which spelt out all the things that I wanted to happen if I were killed, and that he was to meet the ship when we got back and return it to me and never say a word. And that seemed to be certainly cleared my mind, and I thought without actually giving any worries to my direct family. So we sailed that evening. We had a pleasant, relaxed 24 hours, and then we got down to the real business of preparing for war. We instituted the two-watch system, where you do sort of 12 hours a day, 6 hours at a time. We have an 8-hour, and sort of it's a strange watch-keeping system, but it works, and everyone gets 6 hours sleep, which is important. And we let that go for 2 days to get everyone settled. And then we started doing serious drills, action stations every day, every watch we tested the weapon systems, and we really got serious about being prepared. And halfway down, we had to fuel twice on the way down, and we were making the best speed we could. We were in loose company with two Type 21s, who were part of the reserve going down, but we weren't in close company. And we had to find the tankers, and the weather got seriously bad. And at 40 South, which is notorious for bad weather, and I'd been there before as the commander of the little task group, which was sent down in 78 by Mr. Callahan. So I knew the waters quite well. And it was rough as expected. And then we had to find the tanker, which was only a merchant ship, fuel astern in a gale. And it became increasingly more worrying as our percentage of fuel remaining got down to 18%, which is the lowest I've ever been in a ship. And we still hadn't found the tanker, but eventually we found her at midnight with about 17% remaining in a full gale and having to fuel astern, where you had to fuel if you were going to go anywhere. And that sharpened everybody up a lot. The next day we met another tanker and topped up to about 80%. Now we were within 300 miles.